You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with us once again Lynn Alden. And you should go to lynnalden.com to partake of her excellent service. And she has things that are free, and she has some things for very reasonably service as well for investors. But I think anybody who's really focused on the markets can benefit from her work. So it's Lynn Alden, LynnAlden.com. Go there to learn about Lynn's services and also sign up for all that she has to offer, or at least the parts that you feel will benefit you. Thanks for joining us again, Lynn. It's really good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me again. Always happy to be here.
Oh, thank you. And I know that we see you increasingly on various venues, and I'm really happy for you. And you're, I think, for good reason. People are really interested in what you have to say. I'd like to focus on your, I guess it was October 24th letter on value stocks. You said not quite dead yet. Well, they certainly seem to be dead. They've had a horrible time of it, as you point out, this last 10 years or so. So you sort of see the potential for resurgence of value stocks. And as you noted that with about 90 years of data, value stocks have outperformed growth stocks most of the time. I think I saw something like 82% of the time or something like that in your letter. How do you define a value stock and how do you define growth stocks?
So basically, there's no firm definition. For some of this research, I use Russell's definition. But there are other ways to do it. But essentially, value stocks are slower growing, cheaper stocks that generally return value to shareholders in the form of dividends and basically, you know, passing on the earnings to the shareholders rather than reinvesting everything back into the business to grow very quickly. So it's generally a later stage company that is kind of already reached, you know, some degree of maturation and is now in the operating process. And so if you look back over the long term, value stocks outperform growth stocks most of the time. But I've often made the comparison that in many ways, in terms of fiscal and monetary policy, the 2010s were a lot like the 1930s, right? Because the aftermath of the global financial crisis was somewhat similar, but less extreme than the aftermath of the financial crisis that led up to the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And if you compare those two periods in terms of value stock versus growth stock performance, those two decades were also when value did the absolute worst compared to growth.
Mm-hmm.
So outside of those decades, value's generally done quite well, but those two decades were particularly brutal for value stocks.
Mm-hmm. And what's in common with those periods of time? Low interest rates, for sure.
So they had low interest rates, and they also had slow real GDP growth rates. Mm-hmm. And so in those environments, investors flock to the smaller number of companies that are able to grow through that environment. Basically, they have, you know, secular growth potential. They have some sort of new technology or something where even in a difficult economic environment, they're still growing quickly. And so investors are willing to pay, in many cases, very, very high valuations for the few things in a market that are growing. And so whereas if you have a higher rate environment or a more inflationary environment, that tends to benefit value stocks to a larger degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, with low interest rates, your discount factor. So, in other words, there's not a lot of competition when interest rates are. I mean, interest rates are low, so you can afford to. I mean, there's no way to go and earn a safe sort of a low risk return. I mean, as we've seen for some time now, we have these incredibly low rates, and so people are going out on the risk curve, though, to a great extent. It seems to encourage a lot of what I would think of as malinvestment. I remember very well during the 1990s, before the tech bubble burst, you know, I mean, there was all kinds of crazy things that people were putting money into. When you can't, you know, go out and get 5, 6, 7% and you're sort of forced out into a higher risk environment, aren't you? Isn't that what's happening a lot in this environment?
Yes, that's absolutely happened. And one way to basically characterize it is that for lack of good money, people have a tendency to monetize other things. So they sit there and say, well, I can't hold my money in cash because it's yielding below the inflation rate. So they shovel money into, index funds. They shovel money into, say, their home. Anything else that they can that's a little bit more real to them, they shovel money into. And so it tends to push up the valuations because the opportunity cost is so poor, right? The opportunity cost for just holding cash, you don't really get any sort of real return or even treasuries. And so instead, there's a very low hurdle for people just to put their money into other things regardless of valuation. And of course, that can come back to haunt them once they get to extremely high levels.
So in your October 24th report, you noted that it seems like there could be a leveling off of this decline in value versus growth related to the pandemic. I guess with pandemic relief, maybe the prospects of going back to a more normal higher interest rate environment, allowing interest rates to rise to a certain extent, at least. Do you see that happening now?
So I think rates are going to be submerged below the inflation rate for quite a long period of time. But I think the general structural trend of getting to lower and lower rates is pretty much over now. So, they could go sideways for a while. They could eventually start to go up, within a certain band. And so I think that catalyst is off the table for growth stocks. And in addition, if you look at the commodity cycle, obviously, energy is in the value camp, for example. And that had a very, very poor 5 years or so, right?
Yeah.
From that 2014, 2015 period all the way up into the pandemic and the lockdowns and stuff. And so that weighed on the growth to value ratio. But going forward, I think energy is in a much stronger position now. I think it can be overbought for periods of time, right? So it doesn't mean it's going to go up in the next 3 months or so. But I think structurally, energy is likely going to do pretty well in the 2020s. And that's a significant part of the value factor, in addition to other commodities and industrials in general.
Yeah. While we're on the topic of energy, you wrote a paper, you wrote an extensive report on the uranium sector back in September 5th. What are your thoughts now about uranium?
I'm pretty bullish on uranium structurally. I like holding, at this point with these valuations, I like holding the exposure to the underlying commodity, right? So, for example, the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. So part of it is that there's just, for a long time, uranium was priced below the cost of new production. So basically, based on how many nuclear reactors existed, it was projected that eventually you'd have a deficit, and therefore uranium have to go higher price in order to get mines turned back on, in order to expand existing mines, things like that. And so we've had a price jump because of the Sprott activity in the market. But in the same time, we've also had renewed interest from, say, politicians in nuclear energy because of some of the energy crises that we're seeing in China and Europe. And so, the price has gotten higher, but also I think the fundamentals improved. So I'm still structurally bullish on uranium with, say, a five-year view at current levels. Especially with access to the underlying commodity.
I just wonder, with the green movement, everybody wants to go green. One of the ways to do it, in my view, that at least with existing technology and avoid freezing to death, would be to go nuclear. And yet, I know America's nuclear plants are aging, and there's a lot of them that are scheduled to be taken out of commission. So I'm just wondering, where in the world are we going to get our energy, Lynn? Do you see anything technology-wise, using renewables that can save the day for us?
I think it's pretty clear that nuclear is going to have to play a large role because solar and wind are useful for a percentage of a grid. But once they start becoming a very large percentage of a grid, then you need to have a way to store that energy to make up for the fact that they're highly variable. And that's where the extra cost comes in. So generally when you hear, for example, in the media, like solar got below the cost of natural gas or whatever, they're often, assuming that's a small part of the grid and you don't need extensive storage capabilities, right? So once you introduce the storage, that gets a lot more costly, a lot more complex. And those are, unless we have a massive material science breakthrough, those are very slow improving technologies compared to something like software, something that's subject to Moore's law, like processors. So that's a hard material science problem. So overall, I think, you know, basically they can do ESG things until they run into energy crises, which you see in Europe and China. You know, plans change pretty quickly once you face the prospect of not having enough gas for the winter, for example, or not being able to keep the lights on. So things change pretty radically there. They reopen coal plants, they reopen natural gas plants, they do whatever it takes to keep the lights on. And so if they want to fix that more structurally, I do think that nuclear is going to be a bigger role. And China's already kind of announced that to some extent. And there's been a renewed interest in some of these other countries. So yeah, most of the nuclear growth is probably going to be outside, you know, of the developed world, probably the more emerging world, like especially Asia. But I also think if some of the developed countries are smart, they'll probably end up shifting to nuclear being a slightly higher percentage of their grid.
Mm-hmm. Certainly France has done that, but they're sort of an anomaly. After the problems in Japan, a lot of the countries shut down and decided they didn't want to go in that direction. But it's the problems you face now. If people are freezing to death, they might change their minds fairly quickly. And I see our president is talking about, or at least somebody is talking about in his administration, shutting down another pipeline that would bring natural gas through Michigan into the U.S. from Canada. So I don't know. It beats me. But getting back to this value versus growth issue, what can we learn then from, I guess, what I'd like to ask you is, how can we know which direction we're headed? Because it has everything to do. I know that you write about this stuff on a regular basis, so people who follow you will certainly will benefit from your insights into, you know, which direction are we headed? So what can we learn from the 30s and from, you know, from this period of time? Interest rates, as long as they stay suppressed, I just can't imagine. With, I think the PPI is something like 8.4% or something like that now, year over year. I mean, it's incredible to see interest rates, see 10-year treasuries at, I don't know, a couple percent or whatever it is. It's very low. I mean, won't Mother Nature, the market forces eventually, something's got to give, it seems to me, Lynn. You know, as an engineer, I would imagine, you know, what gives way here?
I think what gives way is the value of the currency. And so, for example, if you look in the 1930s to 1940s, you had that slow growth, disinflationary decade. Then obviously you had conflicts, you had the war in the 40s. And basically that resulted in very, very large fiscal deficits that mostly went into the domestic economy, even though a lot of the activity was overseas. Ultimately, war spending, you know, went to things like building factories and GI bills and things like that. So they did this massive kind of wartime MMT type of environment. It was very inflationary. And yet because debt as a percentage of GDP was so high, they just held rates at near zero anyway for 9 years. and so basically just anyone holding cash in treasury just got, you know, 40% of their value inflated away over the course of that decade. And I think overall the transition from the 2010s to the 2020s is going to go along the same route, right? So this is something I've been talking about for a while, and now we're starting to see it play out over the past 6 months or so, where you're getting pretty high inflation without correspondingly high interest rates. And so the Fed's holding short-end rates near zero, and they've also bought a large percentage of the longer-duration securities. There's also been, over the past several years, there's been regulations that basically force institutions to hold more treasuries, right? So money market funds and things like that. So they basically have engineered a collateral shortage. So they've engineered basically a need for these institutions to hold these treasuries, and then they buy a ton of the treasuries. So they're basically, you know, despite the fact that there's so much debt issuance, there's still demand for them, and so they're able to suppress the interest rates for quite a long period of time. Yeah. And I think there will be bumps along the road, So basically the release valve in that environment ends up being that the value of the currency goes down and that you want to be in other types of assets. So it could be value stocks, could be commodities, could be good monies, things like that, basically that are not, you know, negative real yielding cash and treasuries.
Mm-hmm. I just remember as a young man in the 1970s that it seemed the Fed lost control. Of course, that was the 70s. Times were different. The Fed lost control of inflation, and the bond vigilantes came out and really put an end to it and forced it. Ultimately, then Paul Volcker having to pull back the money supply, and You know, we saw our first mortgage is 17.5% mortgage in 1981. So, but I guess you can't really compare the 70s with this point in time. It's quite a bit different. We certainly can't see raising interest rates as a viable alternative for the Fed at this time, I think, any in a very serious way, as Volcker did in 1980.
Well, yeah, exactly. Because if you run the math for, say, $30 trillion in debt, you know, any sort of substantially high interest rates get you into the trillions and trillions per year in interest payments. So basically, mm-hmm. you have a fiscal solvency issue. Mm-hmm. And so that's the same thing I saw in the 40s. Basically, debt was so high, they said, well, there's inflation, but we have to hold rates low anyway. Mm-hmm. And so the Fed can control the short end of the curve. Now, they could do things around the margins. They could raise a couple, you know, 25 basis point hikes here. But yeah. for example, in order to get back to real interest rates, according to, say, official CPI right now, yeah. you'd have to raise rates to like 6% or 5.5%. Yeah. And so that, you know, that's off the table, right? So I think they're kind of stuck in that environment where they're more like the 40s in this sort of currency devaluation environment where the release valve is the currency. It's kind of like, you know, it's like if you have three variables and there's like one or two that you absolutely have to you know, optimize for, which in this mm-hmm. case is basically, you know, nominal repayment of treasury debt, right? Mm-hmm. Then you sacrifice another variable. So I think they're at the stage where they pretty much have to sacrifice the currency in the form of deeply negative real rates. And so that's one of those things where investors, if they're aware of that likelihood, and they can monitor that, they can make sure they're in other assets that benefit from that or at least reduce the harm from mm-hmm. that environment.
Mm-hmm. Might mean buying real things and tangible items to a certain extent.
Yes.
Certainly, if people start to become fearful of rapidly rising inflation, the psychology could change very dramatically, and your currency could probably be destroyed relatively rapidly. But I thought it was really interesting. Daniel DiMartino Booth, who I'm sure you know of, said in a quote in an interview last week, I saw this, she said, "You can't tighten monetary policy when you are heading into a dramatically slowing economy and you have all these zombie companies that will die when rates are higher. And yet you cannot not raise rates given serious signs of inflation." So it's, you know, I think the Fed is really between a rock and a hard place, as they say. And I just would like to ask you if you have any thoughts about the new, the reappointment of the current Fed chairman or possibly Miss Brainard, what difference it might make if she were to be become the Fed chairman. Do you have any thoughts on that?
So I think it probably would not affect the next 6 months or so in terms of monetary policy because they pretty much have their plan set for now. I mm-hmm. think that would have a greater likelihood of affecting the next period of deceleration.
Mm-hmm.
And so overall, you know, Brainard, you get you generally tilt more dovish, so you have more likelihood of, say, formal yield curve control being implemented
mm-hmm.
than under their current approach. But I think ultimately the Fed kind of shapes itself to whatever they are boxed. You know, they're already boxed in a corner, and so they kind of shape themselves to, you know, whatever they have to do. And so, for example, mm-hmm. Powell, you know, he had the famous Powell pivot. He had all these
yes.
plans, mm-hmm. and then when the junk bond market froze for 6 weeks. All those plans went out the window, right? Because mm-hmm. he was trying to tighten into a decelerating economy, mm-hmm. And so things broke. And so, you know, he's been the most dovish Fed chair ever, even though he didn't start that way, right? Mm-hmm. So I think basically, regardless if he stays the Fed chair or we get another Fed chair, they're gonna generally be leaning dovish most of the time, meaning that rates will be below inflation for most of the time, and that basically that there's signs of distress in the treasury market. They'd probably come in and you know, either accumulate them or use their various repo facilities to keep them functioning smoothly, even when they're below the, you know, prevailing inflation rate.
Yeah, so it's probably not going to make a lot of difference who the Fed chairman is, I suppose, if I hear what you're saying, at least not in the short run.
Yeah, I think overall the fiscal outcomes have more impact, right? So. Mm-hmm. So whether or not certain fiscal spending bills pass, certainly I think affects the inflation versus deflation outcome. It's not the only variable, but it's certainly a variable to be aware of. So I think those, you know, certain bills passing or not passing, and specifically what's in them, that will overall matter, I think, for the money system. Whereas the Fed is kind of just you know, kind of like a dog on a leash that it gets kind of pulled along by the Treasury and gets pulled along by the Treasury market in order to keep that functioning smoothly. So I think basically the Fed used a lot of their ammo over the past four decades, and now their job is basically to assist the Treasury in terms of, you know, monetizing debt and keeping yields below the inflation rate. So right. I think they're kind of on autopilot and basically just kind of put out fires that pop up.
Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out in some of your work in the past, we go into these long periods of time when certain segments of the economy do extremely well, become very wealthy. We've seen a hollowing out of the middle class to a great extent. It seems to be ongoing. That then creates certain political pressures that sort of change what happens and the demands that are placed on the Fed to finance all that. And I see we're watching it play out here in real time right now, what's going on in Congress. And I guess it looks like the one bill will be passed, the infrastructure bill, but the more elaborate one we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a key one to watch, because the infrastructure bill spread out over 5 years. So even though it is an amount of money that we used to think of as being a pretty large amount of money, compared to the money supply now, that's I think a pretty small contributor to inflation. The second one that they're looking to pass, I think, is you know, because of the size and numbers involved, it's worth watching that one to see how that's going to affect, you know, the next several years. Mm-hmm. And you know, the math starts to change, you know, when you get closer to, say, the 2022 elections, right? So if there's more split Congress and administration, you're less likely to get things through at that point, right? So yeah. I'm kind of watching this window because it's, you know, we're going to see over the next year what they pass or they don't pass, because I think that'll be pretty important.
All right, Lynn, with just about 30 seconds left, what might we look for your next letter? What are you thinking of writing about next?
So I've written an article about energy, and I think it's due for an update. So I'm probably going to focus the newsletter issue on energy.
All right. Well, folks, LynnAlden.com, go there to sign up for her letter. She has a free letter. It's very worthwhile doing. I can't wait to see it in my inbox every 6 weeks or so, right, Lynn?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. Always a pleasure having you.
And thank you.
Look to have you again sometime soon, hopefully.
Happy
folks, that is all for this week. Next week, I'm going to have Alistair MacLeod with me, as well as Dr. Roger Moss. And so Alistair will be talking about the usual topics of the dollar and gold and so forth. And Roger Moss will be talking about the Kingsway Gold Project, a really exciting news story in Newfoundland. So we hope that you'll join us next week. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Labrador Gold is an exploration company focused on its flagship Kingsway project, located in central Newfoundland Gold District. Labrador Gold's first phase drilling program has successfully identified high-grade gold mineralization, including a 3.6-meter intercept, grading 20.6 grams per ton gold, and 1.85 meters, grading 50.38 gram per ton gold. The company has approximately $35 million in the treasury and is led by a world-class team of CEO Roger Moss and technical advisors Sean Ryan and Quentin Henney.